Okay, as we delve into our second lesson here in Malachi, we have to pause once again to try to understand the religious context of Judaism during this time period. Because if we don't, we're not going to arrive at a proper understanding of Malachi. In fact, much of the material that we're going to talk about today is readily available, but it's also relatively unknown to most Christians. They will not hear this material from the pulpit. It's because pastors do not know it, or the pastors don't believe it has any bearing. But if we're going to be people of the book, if we're going to use a normative method of hermeneutical interpretation, which brings to bear the historical, the cultural, the social, the religious context, and the meaning of the words as the author himself would have understood them and used them, then we have to go back and study these various influences. Now, I'm not an expert on this, nor do I claim that I'm any more of a special teacher than anyone else. I'm not. I'm just a person who reads a lot. I do have some training and skill in hermeneutical understanding of the scriptures, but I am by no means an expert in the languages, or I'm not a historian. But what I'm trying to bring to bear is to get you to understand that much of what you think you know about Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, these post-exilic or exilic books, you have a base of knowledge that's devoid of cultural historical context. And so our understanding of the scriptures are very different from what it would have been had we been in that society. We would have been aware of all these other currents and flows, noises I call them, just like today. If you were to go 200 years in the future and read history books about today, you would find that they would have eliminated a lot that you take for granted. The noise, the cacophony of information that's around you, and how do you pick out what's important from what is mundane? Well, it's very, very difficult because you don't know what's going to be important until it becomes important. And so it's like being blind and trying to follow a thread. Nor can you be in the future and reason backwards, because you usually end up at the conclusion that you want. So that's not a very good way of reasoning either. I mean, we do it, but we have to be intellectually honest. In fact, when we come to study the scripture, that's exactly what we're doing. We're trying to follow the threads back in time, but we have to be strictly, intellectually, scripturally honest. Otherwise, we put the meaning that we want to find there, and like Jack Horner, we pull out a plum and say, "What a good boy am I?" And we're not. Because all we're doing is self-justifying ourselves. And as we're going to see, that's exactly what these people were doing. They were self-justifying themselves. And that was just going to be a problem for them. They consistently rejected the truth of God. Not because they set out to say, "I want to rebel against God," but because they got caught up in the movements of their day. And in seeking to do good, they did poorly. much like today. So there's no difference between them and us. They had the scriptures. They interpreted them in a way that they believed would best suit their purposes, just like we do today. And most of the time, that's going to be incorrect. We're not to put meaning into the scripture or use the scriptures to support whatever position we want to take. We are to come to the scriptures and be instructed by them. And that is very difficult for the flesh to do. So let's go on. The Judaism of Malachi's day, Phariseeism. Now we have to have perspective of these post-exilic books. And as you see from this graphic, Ezra and Nehemiah pretty much are writing somewhat of in the same time period. Ezra was writing first, Nehemiah second, and down in the distance there you see Esther was written in between these two books. It gives us a perspective in which to place Zerubbabel. He was actually of the lineage of David. He would have been one of the princes of the day had the monarchy continued, and thus that's why he was made governor of the first exile. Not because they were going to reinstitute the monarchy, that was going to be absolutely forbidden. There's only going to be one king and one king only, and each nation under the Persian Empire is not going to have their own ruler. They're going to have their own governor, but that governor is going to be strictly loyal to the king, or he's going to be replaced, killed, demoted permanently. We have to remember that Zerubbabel was not just about building the wall. That was part of it. I mean, about building the temple, excuse me. That was part of it. But it was not strictly about rebuilding the temple, because when you rebuild the temple, you have to rebuild the social structure to go with it, the priesthood and supply the sacrificial animals and all the accoutrements that go along with that. And it's therefore a reason to provide that centrality of cultural religious integration. And so you're actually rebuilding a society that had been inexorably changed because of the defeat and the exile. And a word about the exile. It was mainly just the hierarchy that was exiled out, which is what maintains the structure and order and direction of one society. So once you lose those people in positions of power and influence that provide order and direction to that society collapses. It morphs into something totally different. They've come back, and now they're trying to rebuild it. But it's impossible to go back to the original. First of all, they don't know the original. Very few of them do. And those who do are very old. Memories dim. Memories change a lot of things. And then Nehemiah, it's about rebuilding the wall. This is about the political structure. But also in there, you have Ezra, who's kind of like the link between the two, Zerubbabel and Nehemiah. And he is the first scribe. He's what they call the great scribe. And thus begins this professional body that is going to interpret the law. There's a variety of reasons for this. Most people in this day and age cannot read and write. It's not expected of them. Most kings could not read and write. That's why you had scribes. So yes, you're totally dependent upon that scribe because they're reading the messages to you. So you have no way to check their veracity. You have to trust that they're reading correctly. And you have to trust that they're taking your words down correctly and transmitting them outwards. And thus the priests were reading the scriptures in Hebrew, But the people didn't speak Hebrew hardly anymore. They were speaking Aramaic. That was the common language of this whole period. The whole territory, pretty much, of the Persians was Aramaic in various dialects. That's what the people had learned. That's what they had grown up under. Thus, very few of them could speak Hebrew. And very few of them were trained to think and to read and to write, because that's a discipline of the mind. You read and you write. It requires that you be able to think. You have to have structure in your sentences. You have to be able to place nouns and verbs and pronouns and adjectives and adverbs and all these things in a coherent order. Most people, if they're not trained, they just don't do that very well. They just speak without thinking. It's what you learn as you grow and you don't develop a syntax. It's there and you just adopt what's there. And that's the difference between our society, in which we try to train people in these various modalities so that they become thinkers to some degree or another. But anyway, I don't want to get too far off that track. And so here we have these post-exilic books, and we see that their beliefs, their understanding of earlier scriptures, and even of their own role, is very different from how we understand it today. We have to remember that Judaism, like every other belief system, is not a monolithic faith. You go back and you read Exodus, okay, it's what everyone believed. They had to do this, they had to do that, and Noah's allowed to deviate. Well, you know, that's not true at all. If you read the historical section of the Old Testament, you see that they're constantly revising and developing and adapting the laws of Moses. In fact, even during Moses' day, there were several adaptations for extenuating circumstances. There is no monolithic faith, whether it be Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, and people decry the various denominations and belief systems, even in Christianity. But that's just human nature. You can't get two people to agree even to the same interpretation of an obvious fact, let alone an entire belief system. And so we have to understand that, especially during the captivity, when there was no temple in Jerusalem, that how do you keep the faith alive? Because this is your culture. And you've been picked up, tens of thousands of you, and moved to a new locality so that you will not cause an uprising and try to overthrow the new rulers of your land. But how do you keep your society intact? Because if you don't, pretty soon you will be absorbed and take on the culture in which you were transplanted into. You have to remember, there were this perception and this understanding of this danger ever since the time of Balaam. Because that was his advice to Balak. You cannot defeat these people militarily. It's going to be impossible. God has said it's going to be impossible. However, you can absorb them. Get them to intermarriage. They'll take on your religion. They'll take on your coloration. And pretty soon they'll take on your culture and you'll still be king. And that was the plan, and that has always been the plan. And that's been the plan even today. The vast migrations of Mohammedans today is to go into Western cultures and not take on the Western culture, but force the Western culture to take on their coloration. It's very ancient technique. And thus we have this clash of values, this clash of cultures, and people responding to it on both sides in a variety of mechanisms. And so we see this in the world today. Well, this is just what's happening back then. But now that they've come out of the exile a few tens of thousands of them, 20, maybe 30,000 came back with Zerubbabel. How do they rebuild? How do they again pick up the faith around the temple? Temple worship, temple sacrificial system. Because now they have these new factions that have grown up. And of course, the graphic here shows these, and we're familiar with these from the gospel, but we don't know why they're there. We just accept them because they are there. Well, they came out of this Babylonian captivity. You had the Sadducees, which was primarily the priesthood, not exclusively, but primarily is the chosen ones. You have to be of a certain lineage or you're just not going to be in the priesthood. I mean, that was set forth from the very beginning in Exodus, just like you're not a Hebrew per se if you're not of the lineage of Abraham, because that's where the Jews came from. That's what they looked at. You know, the tribe of Levi, unless you're the lineage that traces its roots back to Levi. And we're very familiar with this in the lineage of Christ. He had to come from the lineage of David. And not only is it traced back once, it's traced back twice. Once through the mother's side, Mary's side, once through Joseph's side. So this becomes a very important component of their culture, but this is broken down to a large extent in the Babylonian captivity because there's no temple. At least there's no legitimate temple. We're going to see later on this lesson that yes, there probably was another temple, but it's not the temple. And thus, you have these other factions that come into being, especially the Pharisees. Because how do you keep the faith alive? The priests are involved in the practice. They're involved in following the law and implementing the law. Well, that can't be done anymore. You're living in somebody else's country and under somebody else's laws, and you just cannot rise up and start doing your thing. I mean, that's what the Muslims want to do today with their Sharia law, and we're all against that because that's not what we do. We have our laws here, and if you come here, we want you to follow our laws. In your house, you can follow whatever you want to, but when you come out and interact with us, you have to follow our laws. Just like if we went to Saudi, we would have to follow Sharia. We'd have to follow their laws. In our house, we could follow our laws, but outside our house, we'd have to follow their laws. And thus, that's the way it works here. So they had this body of authority. They grew up apart from the priesthood to interpret the laws. Because how do you practice your faith when there's no sacrificial system? How do you practice your faith when you don't have the legitimate temple to go to? How do you then understand these laws and these interactions of God with your forefathers, and what does that mean to you, and what can you expect now and in the future? All these questions they're grappling with, and it grew up a body of authority to interpret, and usually to allegorize, because you have to remember, Hellenistic influence was spreading outward. There was no Alexander the Great yet, because this is about 100 years before him. And so we're not talking about that kind of spreading of the Hellenistic culture, but we are talking about classical Grecian culture percolating slowly throughout this period as they're interacting. Because remember, Persia and Greece had, the Grecian city-states had history. And they're going to have more history, wars, and they're going to influence each other. The Grecians were great traders and spread their culture throughout this region, as well as picking up the culture of others. Pythagoras in, 7th or 8th century, was traveling around, him and his followers, seeing the cultures of others and coming back to the Hellenistic region and developing over a couple hundred years this form of Gnosticism that then moved outward and started influencing Zoroastrianism and the Old Testament Jews and later on the early church period. His followers found a mathematical relationship between sounds, and it became the Ionic tonal scale, which is what we use today in music. And so we see we have this vast interaction, and we can't ignore it. Malachi is not Moses, and he's not living in Moses' time period. He's living in his time period, and everything is in flux. And that's how he would have understood it. And those are the influences that he would be speaking to before and against. And if we don't understand that, then we don't understand the message. We'll understand a different message that has no relationship to what he's talking about. And we can wax eloquent and write books and build great towering philosophies of nonsense. And we're just sitting in the corner babbling to ourselves. I'm afraid that's what a lot of us actually end up doing. But we don't want to be that way. We want to understand the forces they're facing because it's very similar to the forces that we're facing today. And we're reacting to it in exactly the same ways. Now, what grew up in this time period is later on was called the Great Synagogue. Now, that's a Greek word, means to come together. Knesset, I think, would be the Hebrew word, which they now use in Israel for their parliament. Well, they just didn't make that word up. It's a governing body that comes together. And during the Second Temple period, especially during the Persian Age, which lasted about 34 years or so, after the Second Temple was built and sacrificial system was instituted. But actually, this body of people, though the individual members would be replaced through death or otherwise, probably lasted a couple of hundred years, according to the sources I could find. But this was the body that took upon itself the responsibility to codify Judaism. And that is the basis of the Judaism that we know today. Because as we saw from the previous slide, after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and the dispersion of the population of the Jewish population, in Jerusalem in 133 or so AD by the Romans, the Sadducees, the Essenes, and these various other groups ceased to exist. They basically just faded totally out of existence or near totally out of existence. Judaism, as we understand it today, is a direct descendant of the Pharisaical line. And these are the people that Christ had the most interaction with in the New Testament, not exclusively, but predominantly, because they were the authorities. They had codified Judaism. They had defined the liturgy, the prayers, the form and function of the synagogues, and how to interpret the law and with the scribes, how to promulgate that. And we don't know anything about this because it's not in Christian writings by and large. It's not that we're totally devoid of knowledge, but by and large, most people don't go to read those things. Thus, we don't have a good grasp of this time period. And so Ezra was its leader. He was the founder of it. He was the first scribe. He founded the whole body of knowledge, of the whole profession of the scribes. And as I said, they had a purpose. They had a function. To take what the priests were reading in Hebrew and put it in the language of the people in a form that they could understand. They would probably, if we were going to have to assign them some kind of familiar role, would be the pastors. The priests would not be the pastors. And they're the far-off authorities and reading it in a language that nobody else has been trained in. But the scribes, they're the mediators. They take that ancient language and words which they understand, and then they put it in your language in a means that you can understand. And the Pharisees then take this and write up the rules on how to live. And it's exactly what happens today in the church. You take the scriptures, the pastor takes it in and puts it in a form that you can understand, and then you, as a body, determine how you're going to live the scriptures out. And thus, the Episcopalians will live them one way, and the Anglicans or the Lutherans another way, and the Baptists, you know, a third way, and you get the basic idea how that's going to work. Now, according to tradition, it was 120 men to include prophets. But really, when you go back and you read in Nehemiah and Ezra, there probably was not a fixed traditional number. But it was the leaders of that society there in Jerusalem. And in one of the lists, I think there is over 80 men named. And we can look in Nehemiah chapters 8 through 10, which is seen as the originating group of what has come to be known as the Great Synagogue. Now, whether they called themselves that or not is another issue. They may have just used a term that we're all familiar with, like the Sanhedrin. But what they did do was they began to codify the law. And they saw themselves as a link between the previous Old Testament prophets and the group that was to come after them, the scholars, the Talmudists, the purveyors of the oral tradition, the oral law. And we've talked about them in the past, and we're going to touch on them again here. And so, there was a great change to Judaism in this period because they were rewriting and they were re-editing and they were codifying the law according to traditions and understanding that they had at that point in time. So it would have been different than David and his group would have practiced it, or as people in the period of the judges had practiced it. And it's a body that changes, that grows, that reacts and interacts with the influences in which it finds itself. This doesn't mean it has to pervert and just morph into a godless philosophy, depending on who or whom or what culture it's interacting with. But what it does do is, how do you reach others if you don't understand who the others are and what they think? And Judaism was always interacting with those around it. At least in Jerusalem, it was placed on, God placed it there on major trade routes for a very specific reason. So this knowledge would go out amongst the nations, and not just to force the nations to be like Jews, but to show them the truth of God and as they understood it. And they would be attracted back to it. And we saw that it reached its height in Solomon's period. But it's not the end of it there. Now, what they did do is they canonized the final books of the Old Testament. That would have been Ezekiel and Haggai and Zechariah and Esther, and also the minor prophets, And he possibly would have re-edited early books. Now, later on, I've provided a link to a very good article, historical article, but the gentleman has issues there in that he has taken the defunct and discredited higher textual criticism view that most of these books were written after the exile and thus were changed to pretend the writer was writing before the exile. Well, that means that God lies. And so we want to reject that approach to Scripture. But the article is good in that it gives you a much clearer historical understanding of all the influences, both Judaistic and the foreign influences, Gentile influences, that they were encountering and having to adjust and adapt to. Because otherwise, we just don't understand this period. And, you know, we're happy they built the temple and they built the wall and blah, 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 but we don't understand why that was significant and what they were doing that would cause problems later on. Because as we saw, Ezra was the scribe. He established the body of or the profession of the scribes, but yet later on it morphed into something totally different. And thus, they were trying to develop a system of government that was going to incorporate their truth, God's truth, and yet have to function under this Gentile government, overarching government over them. And thus comes into being that which they had started to develop in Babylon, which has come to be known as the Oral Law or the Talmud, and it got divided into the Midrash, which is really interpretations of the Torah, the Halachot, which is the way, and the Haggadah, which is the lore or the stories or examples of how to implement the Torah and a lot of the allegorical interpretations that they were making up as they were doing this, as they were reading in these now very ancient scriptures and not understanding the truth of them. They were making the same assumptions that people make today, that maybe these are just stories, and so what was God really trying to tell us? And let's pull the truth out, so we'll have to spiritualize it, we'll have to allegorize it. And they were waxing eloquent and writing it down and making great traditions, but terrible hermeneutical approach to understanding the scriptures.